This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the second part of the Financial Sense News Hour, which we affectionately call the big picture. There are a lot of data points out there today that you see coming from the news, whether it's economic news or just political news. But a lot of people have difficulty making sense of all of this. That, like I said, they're just data points. And that's what we try to do here on the big picture, is show you what truly is going on. So I need to ask a question here. The Fed has raised interest rates. This is the third time. That was in March. And more hikes are most likely on the way. We're going to try to put these hikes now into perspective. What does that mean from an investment standpoint? How does it impact you as a saver or an investor or a borrower? And as I said, they made clear more rate hikes are coming. So the question that we have here is, banks are making money. Why aren't you?
One of the first things that happens when the Fed raises interest rates is the prime lending rate goes up immediately. So the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point in March, and the prime lending rate went from 3.75%. It is now at 4%. Last year, the prime lending rate a year ago was at 3.5%. So what does that mean to you if you are borrowing money? There are a lot of loans out there that are tied to two key lending rates. One is the prime rate, and the other one is LIBOR. We'll get into LIBOR as we talk about investment strategies. But the gist of all of this is, if you are a borrower, it's going to cost you more money to borrow. If you own a home and you're refinancing it, it's going to cost you more. If you are a new home buyer, it's going to cost you more to borrow money to buy a home. If you are buying a car, it's going to cost you more money. And if you have credit cards, your credit card interest rate is going up. Now, let me give you an example of what this means. We've had two Fed rate hikes in the last 6 months. We had one in December and we had one in March. So if you look at over the last 12 months, this will give you a clue in terms of what it's going to cost you, the borrower. We'll talk about this in the second part of the big picture, what this is going to mean going forward for the economy. We can summarize it very quickly by saying it's going to cost you more to borrow money. Last year, 12 months ago, the prime lending rate was at 3.5%. Today, it's at 4%. A 30-year fixed mortgage was 3.43%. So let's round it off, 3.4. Today, it's closer to 4.1%. So it's costing you 0.6% more on a regular mortgage. A 15-year fixed rate mortgage has gone up nearly 0.5% from 2.7 to roughly 3.3. Now, a jumbo mortgage, those are mortgages over $424,000, has gone from 4% to 4.62. A 5-year adjustable rate mortgage, those are ones that adjust every 6 months or every year, and they're tied to either prime rate or some kind of benchmark index. It has gone from 2.97 to 3.36. And if you're out shopping to buy a new car, as one of the reasons, as Gary Dorsch and I talked about in hour one about car sales falling out, a 48-month new car loan has gone from 2.87% to 3.36%. And a home equity loan has gone from 4.56 to 4.87. And that is just a demonstration of what happens as the Fed begins a rate raising cycle all across the board, from prime lending rate to mortgage rates to refinance rates to car loans to home equity loans. The cost of borrowing money is getting more expensive. And I don't care if it's you're an individual or you're a corporation going out borrowing money in the bond market. It's one of the reasons we've seen a slowdown in M&A activity.
So if we follow the idea that a lot of the lending rates are tied to prime, prime is up 0.5% in the last two rate hikes. And now the Fed is saying that two more are actually planned. So if prime is at 4% and we assume that they hike it by 0.25%, which they've been doing each time, the prime rate could go to 4.5, which means that borrowing things could become more expensive.
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the things that a lot of strategists, including our own views, is that as we get closer towards the end of the year, because it's widely expected, they'll raise again in June. But they're also going to be tightening interest rates in another way. And we're going to talk about the consequences of this for the economy as we take a look at something that is raising red flags for investors, which we'll get into in our next segment. But eventually, they will do what they've always done. They'll keep raising rates, and they will lead us into another recession. Because as it gets more expensive to borrow, that means a lot more homeowners are not going to be able to qualify for a loan. It's going to be more expensive for businesses to borrow money. It's going to be more expensive for you to go out and buy a new car. As I've shown already, new car loans have gone up by nearly 0.5%. So all of that starts to add up. But it's not just rate hikes that are being planned. And this is a key point we'll cover in the next segment. The Fed minutes, which were released in recently, we've had five Fed governors coming out. They're saying, in addition to raising rates, we're going to start shrinking our balance sheet. And as we talked about in the first hour with Gary Dorsch, for every $0.5 trillion that the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, it's equivalent to a 1% increase in the Fed funds rate. Another way of looking at that is every time the Fed, or if the Fed shrinks its balance sheet by $125 billion, that's equivalent to another 0.25 rate hike. So what they've indicated is in the second part of the year, they are going to start allowing a lot of the bonds that they owe to mature. Because typically what happens now, a bond matures and they just roll it over and they buy another bond. So they keep adding that liquidity to the market. Well, now when a bond matures, the money evaporates. It's just like it was created out of thin air. It disappears out of thin air. It is withdrawing liquidity in the market. Now, right now, the Fed's balance sheet contains about $4.5 trillion worth of debt. About $2 trillion of that is treasuries and the rest is mortgage-backed bonds. The Fed has indicated it wants to shrink its balance sheet from $4.5 trillion down to $2 trillion, which would imply, and personally, I don't think this is going to happen. If they were to shrink their balance sheet by $2.5 trillion, it would imply a Fed funds rate of 5% on top of any other rate hikes. We're already at 1%. There's no way they are going to shrink that balance sheet by $2.5 trillion. I just don't see that is happening.
Well, given the fact that banks are responding to the raising of the prime rate, if you look at things you normally get loans for, say, for example, you have buying cars, buying homes, or just shopping on credit cards, everything's becoming more expensive if you're doing it on any kind of credit because the interest rate's higher. So why is it that long-term rates that were rising have actually been recently falling? That would seem to be a contradiction.
Well, there's two things that happen with the yield curve. The short-term interest rates are controlled by the Federal Reserve. So you've seen three-month T-bill rates go up. You've seen two-year Treasury notes go up. Those things are the things that the Fed controls. On the longer end of the market, that is controlled by the bond market. And the reason that you've seen rates come down is there is a widening gulf in interest rates between the U.S. and other major developed countries in the world. For example, on this Friday, U.S. 10-year Treasury notes, as a result of last night's missile attack, have fallen today to 2.356%. Now, they were at the beginning of the year, they were closer to 2.6%. However, here's why a lot of money keeps pouring into the United States Treasury market. If you go to Germany, interest rates in Germany are a little over 0.2%. If you go to countries like Italy, a 10-year Treasury note in Italy is 2%. In Japan, it's 5 basis points. It's not even 0.1%. And if you go to Britain, today interest rates in Britain are about 1%. So if you are an institutional investor, a pension fund, you are a corporation that needs to invest cash, you are, let's say, a well-heeled, very wealthy individual, the spread between the U.S. and the rest of the world now, interest rates are between 1 and 2% higher in the U.S. So imagine if you are an investor out there and you are investing. It's just like we've done this on last week. We talked about bond funds. You're looking at two bond funds. One bond fund pays 2%. The other bond fund pays 4%. Which one are you going to go with? You're probably going to go with the one that pays 4%. It's no different for central banks, institutions, and wealthy individuals. They're going to go where they can get the highest rate of return. And right now, the highest rate of return, without going into like emerging markets where there's a lot more risk, including currency risk, the best place to get a high rate of return on sovereign debt is the United States, bar none, where interest rates are 1, 2% or more higher than any place else that you can get. So, John, as those rates spiked up to 2.6%, you also saw money come into the U.S. market, institutional and central bank money. So as rates rise in the U.S., which they're expected to do in the next 6 months, because if the Fed's going to raise interest rates, let's say another two times, a quarter of a point, that means three-month T-bill rates will be higher. That means two-year Treasury notes will be higher. Five-year Treasury notes will be higher. So the money will flow into the U.S. Treasury market, and that's going to cap an upward slope of the yield curve. I still think we have a good possibility of getting to 3% this year on 10-year Treasuries, but it's going to cap how far Treasuries can go, because the more that we raise interest rates, remember, they're still doing QE in Japan, and they're still doing QE in Europe. And also, in times of crisis, like, for example, last night with the missile attack on Syria's airfield, Treasury yields dropped today. So the U.S. is perceived in times of crisis as the world's safe haven and also the largest, safest, and most liquid bond market in the world right now. I mean, if you're an institution, you're a central bank, you want to buy 10-year Treasuries in Germany at 0.2%, or would you want to be in Italy, for example, for the risk of 2%? Or would you want to be in Japan at 0.5 or 0.1%? Or, for that matter, Britain at 1%? So that's why money keeps flowing into the United States.
So the Fed has raised rates over the last 12 months. That's what we've been saying, and we've got more to come. And that makes it more expensive to borrow money. But if we flip the coin and say, look at savers. Savers, it hasn't been worth keeping cash in a savings account because the returns have been so low. What does that mean for savers and for investors?
To tell you the truth, not much. Banks have been very stingy about raising interest rates for depositors. And one of the reasons is, as we just talked about, the yield curve, which is the difference between short and long-term interest rates, has not risen that much because foreign buying keeps the long end of the curve down. It's been flattening. So, for example, if you look at what you have available as a saver, we've taken this Friday from Bankrate Monitor. Money market funds are about 0.3%. A one-year CD nationally at a bank is 1.5%. A two-year CD at a bank is 1.7, and a five-year CD is 2.3. If we flip that over and take a look at what Treasury market yields are, is a three-month T-bill is at 0.8%, indicating that the three-month T-bill market and the two-year market is telling us more rate hikes are coming. A two-year Treasury note is slightly less than 1.3%. Five-year Treasury notes are about 1.9, and on this Friday, a 10-year Treasury note is 2.36. That dropped down as a result of the missile attack last night. But here's the problem that you're facing as a saver. First of all, let's take the highest rates out there. On a five-year CD, you can get 2.3%, and on a Treasury note, you can get a little over 2.3%. However, CPI, the inflation rate, is running at 2.8%. So what does that mean? If you are a saver, you are making less in interest than what the inflation rate is. And the core CPI is 2.2%. Now, that's the problem. savers are making less than inflation. Another way of saying is you are losing ground in purchasing power on your investments every single year.
I guess since we're in the season, there's another factor that I'm thinking of. And then what about taxes?
You know, you bring up a good point. Now, if you invest in treasuries, you don't pay any state income tax on the interest, but you do pay federal. And if you take a look at these rates of return, let's take a five-year CD at 2.3 and a treasury at 2.36. The average American out there is between a 25 and 28% tax bracket. So, for example, let's assume you live in Texas or Florida or Washington State where you don't pay, let's say, state income taxes, but you pay federal taxes. If you're in a 25% tax bracket, after you pay taxes of 25% on a five-year CD, it reduces your rate of return. And what happens is after inflation, you are losing 0.5%. If you take a look at federal taxes on a 2.3% five-year CD, your rate of return drops to 1.73% after paying your federal taxes. Now, if you live in a state like I do, California, where the average tax rate is 9.3, after federal and state income taxes on 2.3%, your net return is 1.5%, meaning you are losing 1.3% a year in purchasing power. And that is the key thing. And it's one of the reasons why you've seen, and we talk about this on lifetime income, why it's getting harder and harder for retirees. Because, you know, I guess if you were to say, is there any good news? Well, at least you're making some money. You know, it's hard to believe, but last summer, your rate of return on a money market fund was zero. At least today, it's 0.3%. Last year, during the summer, the rate of return on a three-month treasury bill was negative, meaning you paid the government money. Well, today it's 0.8%. So rates have gone up. They're really not going up at the rate of inflation, and they're not going up at the rate of increases in the Fed funds rate.
Okay, so why aren't the banks raising rates? You would think that the earning rates would float up with the prime as well.
Well, first of all, we're not having a credit boom, so they don't need to compete for your money. I mean, if this was, let's say, 10 years ago when the housing market was hot and banks were funding all their mortgages with short-term deposits, you would have got a higher rate of return because the credit markets were booming. The credit markets aren't booming, so there isn't a lot of competition for money. So quite frankly, folks, they don't need your money. So that's one reason. The second reason, because the yield curve has not been steepening, banks make their profit between what they pay you, the depositor, and what they charge you, the borrower. So banks are going to be reluctant because they want to protect their profit margins because the yield curve hasn't steepened. So they're reluctant to do so. So it's mainly because of profits, number one. And number two, this credit cycle has been weak, so they don't have to compete for money. If you look at global interest rates, T-bills from, let's say, 3 months to 1 year range from 0.75% to 1%. Euro deposits from 3 months to a year range from a little over 1% to 1.5%. The commercial paper market from 30 days to 180 days, which is 6 months, ranges from about 0.9% to 1.3%. In LIBOR, which is the London Interbank Offering Rate, which is 3 months to 1 year, because a lot of bonds and interest rates are tied to that, is 1% to 1.8%. So this is just going to show you how difficult it is if you're keeping your money in cash, if you've been in the sidelines looking for interest rates to get higher, hoping you're going to get a decent return, you're going to be falling further and further behind. And now you're making less than the rate of inflation, which means your purchasing power is declining every single year.
Let us pose a theoretical situation now here. Let's say that you're, you know, a pretty conservative investor. You're going to need about $3,000 to $5,000 a month to live on. How much do you have to invest to generate the return to make that possible?
Well, what I did is I took a 2-year treasury note, which is roughly about 1.3%, and then I took a 5-year CD, which is 2.3%. Now, if you're listening to this, what I'm about to tell you is going to shock you. If you wanted to earn $3,000 a month in interest, just say you needed to make $3,000 a month in interest to live on from your investments, so that's $36,000 a year. If you invested in a two-year treasury note, you would need to have roughly about $2.8 million. It gets a little better if you invest in a five-year CD. You would need roughly about $1.6 million. If you need more than $3,000 a month, let's just say with Social Security and everything else, you live in an expensive state like New York or California, and you need $5,000 a month to live on, which is $60,000 a year, if you invested in a two-year treasury note, you would need $4.7 million, or if you were to tie up your money, which I wouldn't do in a five-year CD, given that rates are rising, you would need $2.6 million. Now, it gets even worse. That $3,000 a month gets reduced to $2,000 a month after you pay your taxes, and that $5,000 a month gets reduced to $3,000 a month after taxes. So that's one of the conundrums, and it's one of the reasons why a lot more Americans today, John, are staying on and working longer because they cannot get a decent rate of return. I mean, think about that. We used to think of a millionaire as somebody that's rich, but just think of this. To earn $3,000 a month, you need to have $2.8 million if you're investing in treasury notes, or $5,000 a month, you would need to have almost $5 million.
So here's the unhappy news, I guess, of all of this, if we squash it together. If you're a borrower, this is talking about rising interest rates, if you're a borrower, heads up, it's going to cost more to borrow money. On the flip side, if you're a saver, well, there's bad news too, because the banks aren't really going to raise their rates much as a result of this, and so you're not going to be finding it worthwhile to save like that, because whatever you do save under this term, taxes and inflation are going to chew it up. So there's got to be some way to make money. What are you doing, Jim, for your clients?
As anybody's been listening to this show, is, you know, we're no longer 100% invested in stocks. We're between 20 and 30% and as high as 35%, depending on client objectives, between cash and bonds. Last year, John, we were able to go in ladder bonds when bond spreads widened between, let's say, corporate bonds and sovereign bonds. But that game is over right now because credit spreads have narrowed. What we're finding to be very effective right now is we're using floating rate bonds, because a floating rate bond, think of it as an adjustable rate mortgage. Every time, and let's say you have an adjustable rate mortgage, what happens every time the Fed raises interest rates, the next time they adjust your interest rate on your mortgage, it goes up. It's the same thing with bonds. We're buying floating rate bonds often at a discount, so we're getting capital gains. But by doing that, we're getting between 4 and 5% on our money. And, you know, to me, if you're talking about maybe the stock market only returning 6% this year, if I can get 4.5% and have preservation of capital, and the Fed's going to raise interest rates, we intend to take advantage of that, because as rates rise, just like your adjustable rate mortgage, the interest rate paid on the bonds rises along with it. So unlike your CDs or your money market fund, which don't go up because banks aren't about to raise your CD rates, bank or your money market rates at a rate that would be commensurate with the rise in the Fed funds rate, we are participating with rate rises along with the Fed. So we're doing what bankers do. And so, you know, I'd rather make 4.5, 4 or 5%, and I think we'll be making closer to 5 if you factor in two more rate hikes. So as rates rise, yields will climb higher and we'll get a higher rate of return. So the next move that we are seeing besides floating rates is, as the economy begins to weaken, we're going to see a rise in credit spreads between corporate bonds. They will start to widen, and when that happens, we'll go into probably short-term bonds, because we're looking for minimums of getting 3.5 to 4%. So right now, we're doing floating rate bonds, so our rates rise along just like the prime lending rate. So we're doing the same thing the banks are doing, and it's, you know, one of the strategies that I think is going to be very effective here until the Fed stops raising rates.
All right, but you're talking here about lessening your stock position. Do you see yourself doing more of that?
Oh, absolutely. And especially as we get further along, if this market heads higher. Because like our technicians have told you on the program, a market top is sort of a rounding process. It takes place over time. You're not going to wake up one day and they're going to ring the bell and say, okay, that's it. That's the market top. So what you should do, as any good investor should do, is you start raising your cash and start getting defensive as the market moves higher. Instead, what we've seen, which is alarming, as more people are pouring money into stock funds saying, wow, the stock market is at records. Although I think some of this turmoil and what the Fed is doing, it'll be interesting to see how far they go, especially if the economy starts to weaken. But right now, we're on tap for another rate hike coming as soon as June. So the result of that is we'll be moving as rates head higher. We'll be moving more into cash and bonds because we're getting a rate of return. If I can get 4 or 5%, and not risk principal, I'd rather do that than take the risk of thinking we are smart enough to know the final day that the stock market tops and we'll get out on that day. That's just not the way things work in the real world.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If you think about where rates are right now at 1%, with inflation running at 2%, the real rate of funds in the economy is still at negative approximately 100 basis points. And we think that at that level, the Fed funds rate is very, very accommodative. So the notion that the Fed moving from emergency levels to a little bit more accommodative levels and still keeping real rates at least now at negative 100 basis points and then gradually moving to the positive territory is, in fact, if anything, better from growth from a financial transmission channel.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here. And if we do a segue from the last segment, why they spell it S-E-G-U-E? I don't know. It looks like segue.
No, it's actually segu.
Segu?
Yeah.
Well, it looks like that. All right. Segueing from the last section, the Fed has raised interest rates 3 times in 3 years. And they are telegraphing to us that they're going to do it again. Actually, that concept of telegraphing comes more from a martial arts thing. More expensive to borrow money as a result of that. But at the same time, savers are getting diddly. In other words, so the saving return rate is not going up with the borrowing rate. And now the question is, which we have posed before, but I guess we need to revisit it again. If they try to keep raising the rates, are they suddenly going to have to backtrack on that? Because typically the Fed's indicator that something is wrong is when something goes poo and breaks in the economy. And then they go, oops. Of course, they never say oops. They do it in a very formal way in terms of Fed speak. And then they say, I guess we've done it enough in the economy, because the question remains, is the economy strong enough to actually withstand the rate hikes, shrinking the balance sheet? That was something else they were talking about doing, given the low rate of growth. And you remember back in 1937 when the Congress and FDR decided it was time to raise taxes and the economy was actually recovering. And as soon as they did that, whoa, down it went. And that was it. The U.S. economy cannot be said to be heating up by any means today. As a matter of fact, we're in the weakest recovery since World War II. That's what we have experienced. So the question is, could they be making a big mistake? And if so, what's it going to look like?
You know, John, I think if they start withdrawing liquidity from the markets by shrinking their balance sheet in combination with rate hikes, then I think they could be making a big mistake. Because, I mean, if you look at where we've come in 3 years since they announced the taper, the bottom of the market was May 2014, where the shadow funds rate got to a negative 3%. So we've gone from a negative 3% to 1%. So that's equivalent of 4 full percentage points in raising rates. Now, if you look at what the futures markets are telling us, and over the years, we have relied more on the futures market because they've been more accurate in terms of what the Fed's actually going to do. Because the Fed always starts out the beginning of the year, as we've discussed here numerous times, telling you what they're going to do. This year, they said 3 times. All right, they've already raised it once, which was a break from years past where they start out the year saying they're going to raise it and they wait to the end of the year and only raised it once. But if you look at the futures market, which is, by the way, more in line and closer to the Fed's dot plot than it's ever been. So the wide spread between what the Fed is projecting and what the futures market is projecting has narrowed, and they're going in tandem now. There's roughly about a 68% probability that the Fed will raise in June, and we're starting to see that on the short end of the stick. You already have 3-month T-bills starting to rise a bit, and I suspect as we get more evidence that the Fed is going to raise, you will see 3-month T-bills rise in advance of that. The next probable area is September and November. And the probability of a rate hike in September and November right now stand about 36%. The biggest percentage, which is close to 40%, is in December. So if we were to boil it up, what the markets are expecting is a rate hike in June and then another rate hike in December. But what is also going to happen, according to at least what the Fed is indicating in its minutes to its meetings, and recently by speeches by 5 Fed governors, they're saying, we are going to start shrinking our balance sheet in the second half of the year. And that's another form of tightening. Now, how would they do that? They would do that as bonds are maturing. They would simply not renew those bonds and that money would disappear in thin air. In other words, the Fed would not take that money, go back into the marketplace and buy new bonds to replace those that are maturing. So as they shrink their balance sheet, they're also shrinking liquidity in the financial markets. Now, here are some key numbers. In 2017, there's roughly $205 billion worth of bonds maturing, $374 billion in 2018, and another $329 billion in 2019. So roughly over the next 3 years, they could shrink their balance sheet by $1 trillion. Now, Gary Dorsch and I talked about shrinking their balance sheet by $500 billion is equivalent to a rate hike of 1 percentage point in the Fed funds rate. Another way of looking at that is every $25 billion that the Fed allows to evaporate or shrink from its balance sheet is equivalent to a 1/4 point rate hike on the Fed funds rate. Well, we know 2 more rate hikes are in the works, at least at the current time. And if they shrink their balance sheet by $200 billion, that would be equivalent of another 1/4 point rate hike. So we could be at 1 3/4 or 2% equivalent on the Fed funds rate by the end of the year. And it's one reason why we expect sometime either in the 2nd or 3rd quarter that we're probably going to likely see a top in the stock market. So we already have 5 governors. We've had Fed minutes and they've been on this message consistently since the end of last year. It's time not only to raise interest rates, but it's also time to shrink our balance sheet. And unfortunately, that could start this summer, if not in between. And that is more, I think, than this economy can withstand. We've already seen a pullback in automobile sales. Automobile dealers are now having to put great incentives to move cars off the lot. Inventories are starting to build up at car dealerships. The housing market sales have stalled a little bit. A lot of that has to do with lack of supply than it is demand. But as mortgage rates head higher, as I expect them to do, it's going to be more expensive to buy homes. And that is going to create some problems in the housing market as that is weakened.
Yeah, one of the things I remember you saying quite a bit here on the show is that all recessions have been preceded by Fed rate hikes, which maybe tells you that the Fed never learns a lesson. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. But all of that aside, what we're implying here is that as rates rise and it gets more expensive to borrow for anything you're going to buy, that would include businesses and anything they're going to use for expansion or that people are going to use to improve. So that tends to be curtailed.
Well, all recessions are not only preceded by Fed rate hikes, but they also begin when bank credit finally stops. And if you take a look at the latest senior loan officers surveys, there's been a slight increase in tightening. But investors should be on alert. There's something else that nobody else is watching, and that is the money supply is starting to slow. In every recession, which has been preceded by rising rate hikes, they've also been preceded by a stop in credit and a drop in money supply growth to zero or negative. And so right now, we have two things that are going on. We have the Fed raising interest rates. We have bank credit tightening. And I should say a third thing that's happening is the money supply is starting to shrink. And one of the reasons we've seen bank credit basically tighten is due to a number of factors, excessive regulation, and the fact there just isn't a strong demand for credit. And that will get less and less as it gets more expensive to borrow. So you have three things that are going on now simultaneously. One factor with the Fed starting to shrink its balance sheet is going to heighten this. Fed rate hikes, a shrinking balance sheet, and a falling money supply. Year over year, as of the end of March, money supply is slowed to a growth rate of only 3.7%. It was growing in the 5 to 7 and 8%. It has now fallen to 3.7%. So this is a red flag out there. And I want to point out, and we don't know this at this point, so that's why we are on alert status, watching all these things occur at the same time, because we've had false signals in the past. A good example was in 1984 and 85, when rates went up, money supply fell. A lot of that was done as a result with the dollar. It happened again in 1994 when the Fed funds rate doubled from 3 to 6%. So the money supply fell between 1994 and 95, but then went on as Greenspan expanded the money supply. The real risk here is when you get to the zero line, meaning you have no increase in the money supply, and that's usually at the point where credit comes to a standstill. And so we're not at the zero line yet, but year over year, we have slowed substantially.
Yeah, I'm sort of musing about all of this because if we have to look historically, the Fed typically does this type of rate raising when the economy is overheating, and it's also reflected in inflation noticeably being on the rise. We really can't say the economy is overheating. So do you have any ideas as to why the Fed would be doing this?
Well, they didn't want to stay in a negative interest rate environment because basically they have no ammunition. What do you do the next time we have a financial crisis or we get into a recession? So they're trying to normalize monetary policy because you can't say inflation is raging, although it's up year over year by 2.8%. So it's above the Fed's rate. I mean, CPI is. Of course, the Fed uses another inflation measure, which is probably a lot more benign than the CPI. But if you take a look at, for example, we've talked about this, corporate profits for non-financial companies have peaked in 2015. And even though they've gone up recently, they have not gone up if you adjust corporate profits for inflation. For example, let's say I'm a company and I have $100 in sales and I make 10% in profit. So I make $10 in profits on $100. Now, let's say I raise my prices by 2% or 3%. So instead of $100, next year I have $103 in sales because raise my prices because of inflation. And let's say my profits go from $10 to $13 because I raised my prices. My real profits haven't gone up because if inflation is 3%, I'm just keeping even. So real profits in the economy peaked in the summer of 2015. And right now, on the positive side, the money supply is still up year over year, but its rate of increase is shrinking and has fallen dramatically. So that's a red flag. What we don't know, is this a false signal at this point? But what we do know, as the Fed continues to tighten, you are going to see a rapid drop in the money supply, which is what we've seen in the last 6 months. And what has happened in the last 6 months? The Fed has raised interest rates twice. They raised it in December. They raised it in March. And even more so, as the Fed begins to shrink its balance sheet, it is going to be withdrawing money and liquidity from the stock market. And what do we know about this stock market? It has been liquidity driven these last 8 years. It hasn't been because of robust economic growth. It has been with some increase in profits, but a lot of those profits came from financial engineering as corporations bought back stock, they refinanced their debt, and they used that to shrink their supply of shares, and that drove up profits. So a lot of this came from financial engineering. It did not come from robust economic growth. So that is something that we are now on alert for, John, because now that the Fed is talking about shrinking its balance sheet, we're watching what happens not only to these rate hikes, so we're going to be watching a number of other factors that have now raising, in other words, more caution signs for us on the market going forward.
Anything that might offset it, because the other thing, of course, would be taxes. So what if they manage to get a tax cut through the Congress, or say more spending on infrastructure, which, as you well know, we need to do on a lot of our highway bridges and other things?
Well, I mean, that's been the talk. That's what's moved the market since Trump's election. It's been moving on three things: tax cuts, infrastructure spending, and deregulation. And as we saw with the attempt to repeal Obamacare, that didn't work. And even when it comes to tax cuts, there's wide disagreement. First of all, Democrats are going to oppose anything that Trump proposes, and they are dead set against any tax cuts. But even within the Republican Party, there are wide disagreements between both factions within the party of how much to cut tax cuts, what to cut out. Should we have a border adjustment tax? Should we cut out certain itemized deductions? And of course, you have all the special interest groups that are going to be lobbying their congressmen to protect their various tax deductions. So even within the Republican Party, there's disagreement. But I would say, John, we now have another red flag or another warning sign, you know, so I guess, you know, it's time to start slowing down the speed of the car because there's a lot of cautionary signals.
So if we assume that they're going to keep raising and that at some point something will break, what are the indicators that you're watching to tell you that the storm is on its way?
Well, outside the probability of future rate hikes, we are now going to be watching the Fed's balance sheet. That's reported on a monthly basis. So we're going to watch for shrinkage, which is going to tell us further tightening. Secondly, we're monitoring the money supply. Third, we're monitoring bank credit. And fourth, which would be the leading economic indicators to tell us that either the economy is picking up or it is more likely to roll over.
And then let's assume that those things do continue, the four things in a negative direction. What will you do for your clients?
I suspect, John, we will probably be doing what we've been doing since last fall, and that's gradually raising cash in our short-term bond and floating rate bond position and taking profits off the table in the equity market. Because once again, you know, these are the subtle things that all of a sudden, one day, it's going to be one event. I don't know if it's a GDP number, if it's an unemployment number, or it's a series of economic statistics. But that will be the point, as we have talked about, the way these things play out. The first thing to peak is the bond market. That has already done so. It peaked last summer. The second thing to peak will be the stock market, and finally will be commodities. So the next thing that we're looking for is a peak in the stock market.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Here's a flashback from the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, recorded earlier in the week.
In a complex adaptive system, you're going to have all these interacting agents that together they form something more than the sum of their individual parts. And there's an emergent property to them. So like a school of fish, some sort of behavior within that school emerges that you can't foresee that happening, a priori know it's going to happen. That's happening in our market systems because our market systems are also complex adaptive systems. And so it is true that I think that autonomous weapon systems, when they're linked together in this way in a future battle space, could look exactly like a complex adaptive system, and that how they are networked together and how they communicate with one another, because they're going to communicate in ways that are completely not foreseeable to how you and I would communicate through use of natural language like English, that they will start to engage in behaviors that we can't foresee.
So welcome back to the last part of the big picture today. United States strike on Syrian airbase late in the week caught everybody by surprise, at the very same time that Chinese Prime Secretary Xi Jinping was at the Trump White House in Florida for dinner. The response to that has been interesting around the world. Sunni majority countries like Saudi Arabia have been praising the missile strike. The U.S. did give Russia a one-hour warning before launching the missiles, but Russian relations with the U.S. now seem to have moved into a limbo period. Russia is sending a warship to protect the Syrian coast. Iran and, of course, Syria have condemned the attack along with Russia.
Really?
You wouldn't expect that, would you?
No, not at all.
No, I wouldn't think so. UK, France, and Australia supported the action along with a Syrian opposition group called the Syrian Coalition. And Germany said that Assad bears responsibility for the U.S. strike. France said the same thing. So Russia did shut down a confliction channel in Syria with the U.S., which made sure U.S. troops did not enter into conflict with Russian troops in Syria. They've also been dealing with airspace issues between them and the Israelis and the U.S. and everybody who's flying there, so we don't all wind up starting to shoot down each other's jets, etc. So that's sort of the background. Turkey called for the ouster of Assad. Of course, Erdogan has his own dictatorial issues, but that's the geopolitical part. It caused a major upset in the political arena here in the United States because some of the narratives that have been running on Capitol Hill and also in the media got flipped over as a result of that, and there was a scramble to recover the narrative. So where do you think this is all heading now? Where are we going to take this?
You know, there was a great editorial piece in the Wall Street Journal today by Gerald Seib. And one of the things that has confounded many world leaders is President Trump is unorthodox and unpredictable. For example, if you look at some of the campaign things he talked about, is the U.S. shrinking from engaging in the world's hotspots, similar to the 8 years of the Obama administration. So there was a thought process here that there's a continuation of that same thinking carried over from the Obama administration. But if you look at who he appointed as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who he appointed as Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, he surrounded himself with military generals, and also what the U.S. is doing, number one, to protect South Korea against missile launches by North Korea. The U.S. is now installing its missile defense system, THAAD, which we talked about on the show last week. So here we are installing a missile defense system in South Korea. China's president, China's been moving aggressively in the South China Seas, is visiting Trump having dinner while cruise missiles are being launched at Syria. So, I mean, there is a power shift that is taking place here. And there's kind of two sides that these world leaders are trying to gauge. Is it America and Trump disengaging from the world as Obama did? Or is this Trump the tough guy? And what emerged on Thursday was Trump the tough guy, which took the Syrians and the Russians, and I'm sure the North Koreans and everybody else that's watching, by surprise. The other thing that, as we covered on the show last week, we covered this arms buildup that's taking place with Russia and China, although Russia's arms buildup is insignificant compared to what's going on in Saudi Arabia and what's going on in China. Actually, Saudi Arabia is spending more on defense in total than Russia is, because they have the money and the means to do it. Russia's economy has been hurt not only by the price of oil, but also by sanctions. But if you take a look, as we covered last week on the show, and I recommend that you look at the Heritage Foundation and the Navy's perennial review, the Navy just issued a major report in terms of their needs. The Navy needs about 75 ships. We have about 280 ships in the U.S. Navy. They're saying to engage and do the task that they have been given by Congress and the President, they need 350 ships. Instead of 10 carrier battle groups, we used to have 12 when Obama was president. We're down to 10. The Navy says they need 13. How do you project power around the world? You project power through a Navy. And if you take a look at the Trump military budget, he's proposed an increase of defense spending of $54 billion a year. Most of that is going to go for rearmament. In other words, weapon systems, more Navy ships, more carriers, more submarines, more destroyers. The U.S. has just come up with a new destroyer with a rail gun on it. So we are still advancing our technology, which is still about 10 years ahead of the competition. So there was a strong message that we're sending here. A missile defense system in South Korea. Japan is thinking moving towards rearmament. And you also had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson implying, if things don't change in South Asia, that they may allow Japan and North Korea to have nuclear weapons. And so there is a major power shift that's going on here. Defense stocks are up anywhere from 1% to 2% on Friday. But John, once again, as we have always pointed out here on the program, there's three aspects to investing. There's the geopolitical, there's fundamentals, and there's technicals, and you need to have your eye on all three right now.
Well, that was short but sweet. Given everything that's been going on geopolitically this week, I think we're going to trail this into next week. We do have some earnings reports to start coming out, so what are we looking forward to in the weeks to come?
I would say, John, we're going to be watching the LAIs. We had got a weak employment report on this Friday. It was less than expected, so that's something to keep your eye on. But we have a slew of corporate earnings that are going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And we have contended here, if there's going to be another catalyst to drive stock prices higher before they peak, it's going to have to come from corporate earnings, because it's certainly not going to come from the Federal Reserve with the Fed talking about further tightening. Some of the short-term interest rates are starting to reflect the next tightening, which could be as soon as June. That's probably less than 2 months away. And we're already starting to see that. And then so we're going to be watching corporate earnings. I think that's going to be the story, but we're keeping our eye on credit. We're keeping our eye on the Fed's balance sheet. We're keeping our eye on the money supply. And, of course, economic indicators to tell us, you know, the Fed's going to have to start asking itself a question. If these economic numbers continue to weaken, you could see a reversal in the probability of a rate hike coming in June. Just as we saw the same thing happen last year after a weak first part of the year. And I think, quite honestly, the only reason the Fed worked and moved in March was the stock market. You watch the stock market start to falter 5, 10%, that June rate hike comes off the table. So a lot of stuff to watch and keep your eye on now. There are a lot of things and variables that are all moving right now. Fundamentals are moving, technicals are moving, and as we saw last night, geopoliticals are also moving as well. But we'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.